There's a long history in this country of government agencies working hard to declare black people enemies of the state.
We were pounding on the door, and my son answered, and we had security gates at the time, luckily. So he answered the door, and they said, OPD, open up, and he slammed the door quickly and said, no, thank you.
Yes, we are all susceptible to COVID, but some of us are a lot more susceptible than others because of the legacies and ongoing realities of racism in our economy and our society.
From Pacifica Radio, KPFK in Los Angeles, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches people's lives. I'm your host, Nana Jumpfy. In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, when the current economic system seems to be failing the majority of the U.S. population, we discuss an alternative, solidarity economics in the time of COVID, with Dr. Manuel Pastor. We then hear from folks who led a successful rent strike in East Oakland, California, and an update from the front lines of the fight for fair working conditions with the Bay Area's Labor Video Project. But first, the news with Maeve Conran from Pacifica Radio affiliate KGNU in Colorado.
Indigenous leaders are calling Donald Trump's rally at Mount Rushmore on Friday a racist display that violated Indigenous sovereignty. The monument in the Black Hills of South Dakota is on land that is sacred to the Lakota Sioux. It was built on land that the government stole from them, and it celebrates the European settlers who killed Native Americans and appropriated their land. Furthermore, the sculptor of Mount Rushmore was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Members of different Native American tribes protested at Trump's event on Friday. Chairman Harold Frazier of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe said in a statement that we're now being forced to witness the lashing of our land with pomp, arrogance and fire, hoping our sacred lands will survive. Concerns were also raised about the possibility of tribal members being put at needless risk for the spread of the coronavirus. Native American tribes have been hardest hit by the virus. Tribes were already dealing with ongoing and persistent underfunding of American Indian health systems and have been given little federal assistance during the pandemic. Globally, COVID-19 cases continue to spike, with some countries reimposing lockdowns. The World Health Organization says there are now more than 11 million confirmed cases worldwide, with over 500,000 deaths. The US has about a quarter of all global cases, with 2.9 million confirmed cases and 130,000 reported deaths. Crowds flocked to beaches over the July 4th weekend in states like Florida, Texas and California, which had already been grappling with spikes in COVID-19 cases. Late last week, residents of Starr and Hidalgo counties in Texas were told to shelter in place as local hospitals were at capacity due to the virus. Florida reported nearly 11,500 new cases on Saturday and almost 10,000 new cases on Sunday. This morning, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that states can mandate that Electoral College voters vote for the winner of a state's popular vote in the presidential elections. In 2016, 10 of the 538 presidential electors tried to vote for someone other than their pledged candidate in an attempt to stop Donald Trump from taking the presidency. The Supreme Court was ruling on a case from Colorado where several electors tried to vote for Republican John Kasich instead of Hillary Clinton, who won the state's popular vote. One of those electors, Michael Baca, was removed by state officials from his role as an elector. Baca brought a lawsuit against the state of Colorado, arguing that electors are free agents with the power to vote for whomever they choose. Today's Supreme Court ruling overturns a 2019 ruling from a Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver, which had said that the state of Colorado acted outside of the bounds of its constitutional power when it punished faithless electors. On Friday, two police officers in Aurora, Colorado, were fired for posing in a photograph last year near where Elijah McClain was confronted by police officers. McLean, a 23-year-old black man, died last August after being detained, put in a now banned chokehold by police officers and injected with ketamine by first responders. He was not breaking any law, but there had been a report to 911 of a suspicious man. No officers were ever charged in his death. McLean's death at the hands of police has received renewed attention in recent weeks, with the nationwide rallies calling out racism in policing. For Pacifica's COVID, Race and Democracy, this was Maeve Conran from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado.
You are listening to COVID, Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumpfee. The negative effects of COVID-19 on the U.S. economy are generally expected to serve as a divisive tool and wedge issue in the upcoming November elections and for some time to come. While some experts look for ways to address the pandemic-related economic crisis with the usual focus on appealing to individual self-interest, our guest, Dr. Manuel Pastor, offers an alternative model, solidarity economics. Dr. Manuel Pastor is a distinguished professor of sociology at the University of Southern California, where he currently directs the Equity Research Institute. His research has generally focused on issues of the economic, environmental, and social conditions facing low-income urban communities and the social movements seeking to change those realities. His most recent book is State of Resistance: What California's Dizzying Descent and Remarkable Resurgence Means for America's Future. Welcome, Manuel. So honored to have you join us.
I'm so glad to be with you. I love the work that you do and the work that, in particular, BAJI, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, does in terms of figuring out how we can both center the struggle against anti-Black racism and make sure that we're including our immigrant brothers and sisters in the struggle. Fantastic.
Thank you so much. It is work done much easier with comrades like you. Explain for folks, because it almost sounds like an oxymoron to most people, what is solidarity economics and how does that differ from the current model we're used to thinking of?
Well, let me give a common sense explanation first, then I'll give a little bit of the kind of history and roots of it. But you know that if you treat your neighbors better, you know that if you own a business and you treat your workers better, you know that if you patronize a business, they treat you well, you treat them well, that everything works out better in the economy. And what's odd is that we've organized an economy in completely the opposite direction from that. That is, we've organized an economy of ruthless competition, of cutthroat activities, and all of that has been essentially to serve the interests of giant corporations. So when we think about solidarity economics, what we tend to think about is that the traditional economic model, neoliberalism, assumes that people only act out of their self-interest, and that when they act out of their self-interest, that somehow prosperity will result. This is the reason why, if you ask generally any traditional economist, if there's a problem in the economy, what should be done? They say, well, just let the market take care of it. The market will take care of racial discrimination. The market will take care of a lack of housing. We've seen how well that's worked. If you think about the way that most of us on the left have traditionally thought about how instead to address that, we often say, well, the state needs to jump in. That if you're trying to correct the housing market, the state needs to play a role. If you're trying to correct the environment, the state needs to play a role. While all of that makes sense, particularly in people of color communities, we know how bad the state is at getting things right. After all, it's the state that's helped to bring us sustained police brutality such that there's a generalized uprising going on right now against policing in America. So what solidarity economics does is it says really three fundamental things. One is people don't just act out of their self-interest. They often also act out of mutuality. Second, that when people act out of mutuality, we can actually generate more prosperity over the long haul. So when we are really looking out for other people and trying to make sure that we're investing in public education for everyone, we're trying to make sure that everyone has a job. We're trying to make sure that small businesses, particularly those owned by people of color that have been disenfranchised economically, we know that that generates a better economy. The third sort of precept of solidarity economics is that the only way we're going to get to a better economy is through solidarity with one another and through power. That is, by creating the kind of systems of organizing and social movements that can disrupt the current power relations that maintain a dysfunctional economy. It is not functional for an economy to have this level of corrosive inequality. It is not functional for it to have an economy that puts so many people in prison and wastes their talent. It is not functional to have an economy where so many of our brothers and sisters are living with insecure immigration status and therefore are not able to fully realize their own dreams or fully contribute to our community well-being. And so we know that that level of racial disparity, of worker disenfranchisement, of immigrant insecurity serves someone's interests. And that is the interest of gigantic corporations. So three big things. The economy really should be organized around our mutuality. Two, that when we do that, we will actually generate more economic growth and prosperity that will benefit everyone. And third, that we're only really going to get to the kind of economy and society that we want for ourselves if we organize and use social movements to change the balance of power that keeps this dysfunctional economy in place.
That sounds so good. This is the reason that I want us to make sure that we spread the word about this way of looking at economics and looking at how we look at each other with respect to economics, so important in this time. How would solidarity economics help those who are most impacted by the COVID pandemic?
Well, I think the COVID pandemic is almost like a sales pitch for solidarity economics, because one of the things that we've kind of realized in the midst of this big crisis is we now know what essential work is, and it's not being the manager of a hedge fund. It's being a grocery store clerk, a bus driver, a healthcare worker, a janitor who keeps our buildings clean, a farm laborer who makes sure that food is coming to us, etc. We know what essential work is, and it's work that's been long treated as disposable, as sacrificial, as not worthy of respect.
Dr. Manuel Pastor is a distinguished professor of sociology at the University of Southern California, where he currently directs the Equity Research Institute.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Oakland, California is facing an avalanche of evictions since the statewide moratorium expired on the 1st of July. Poor News Network brings us a conversation with folks who have carried out a successful rent strike and have managed to reach their goal of securing a community land trust in order for their families to stay housed.
We're in a house in East Oakland that we had squatted and managed to maintain for 3 years. At the end of that, we found ourselves in the same situation we were before that, except in more dire straits because there was even less housing and the barriers to housing were even more significant at that point. And we'd just been completely and totally priced out of the market. So we put an ad on Craigslist. It was a cute little picture of our family saying, these are the skills that we have to offer and we're willing to trade them in exchange for below market rate housing. So it was like painting and food preparation and cleaning and maintenance, you know, basic things that we thought we could maybe trade or barter. We were discovered a month and a half into our stay OPD came, and that was a real challenge. They rolled in at 7 in the morning on a Sunday. They had 7 officers. They were pounding on the door, and my son answered, and we had security gates at the time, luckily. So he answered the door, and they said, OPD, open up, and he slammed the door quickly and said, no, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
After that, it really drew a lot of heat. A lot of heat to the building. The very next day they came and started taking everybody's security gates down. But we managed to get everybody on the same page and fighting in the same direction. And it was pretty exciting after that. We were in my neighbor. Oh, and then part of what got the property owner to take a step back was that the long-term tenants in the building filed a lawsuit against him. And so when he came on property, we were able to serve him. And that was, you know, mm-hmm. a changing of the tide is what it felt like.
Right.
It was pretty significant. And, you know, they were using all kinds of tactics. Bernie, the fake attorney, he threatened to call Child Protective Services, which was really alarming for everybody in the building. My family, we've got 4 kids, and, you know, that was, it was just a lot. And at that point, we just told them to go away because we weren't going to entertain any more of their tactics.
Right.
The house was lost through foreclosure, and the person who ended up in possession of the house is a private money lender who lives in Oregon, and he didn't have any interest or intention or desire to be a landlord in Oakland, so he was looking to unload the property as quickly as possible. He found a buyer, and we had been in the process of trying to identify a land trust or some way that we could collectively purchase the property ourselves. Part of our fear was that it needed so much work.
Yeah.
It needs so much work. But we were able to deter the potential buyer, and we did that by surprising him on a number of occasions, researching him. Yeah, so... Wow. Through the Bay Area Community Land Trust, we closed on the house last week, and we are now situated, and not only are we situated, but we don't have to worry about this house falling down around our ears because it's pretty close to a red tag. Through a city program, we were able to secure a significant amount of funding that's going to allow us to do all the upgrades that are needed.
Thanks to the Poor News Network, whose radio news broadcasts touch on many issues impacting youth, adults, and elders in poverty, locally and globally. Their work can be found at poormagazine.org. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.
El burgués estafador, le explota y de qué manera.
¿Cuánto vale un jornalero que recoge la basura? Esta labor sucia y dura la realizan los obreros. Los hombres honrados.
Welcome back to Pacifica's national broadcast, COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Nana Jumphy. Because of the coronavirus, African wildlife refuges are suffering from the loss of tourist revenue that most depend on. However, prominent African conservation scholars say that the difficulties simply expose that the neo-colonial conservation model should have been abandoned long ago. Anne Garrison has the details.
Kenyan ecologist Mordecai Ogata, co-author of The Big Conservation Lie, says that Kenya is using not only the neo-colonial model of conservation, but also the industrialized world's response to the coronavirus.
The effect of the rules brought in has been the clampdown on movement. We've got homes now that we can't go to. We've got family we can't visit. And sadly, we've sort of copy-pasted some of these actions from countries where people don't have rural homes to go to. People don't have upcountry villages or farms to go to in Europe. In Europe and even many parts of the Americas, where you live is where you are and that's your whole life. They don't have the connections we have. And I think it's very unfortunate that we've sort of wholesale copied some of the actions they're taking without putting them into our context, because so much of our mental, commercial, and even natural resilience comes from ability to go to rural homes. You can see it whenever there's a trauma in this country or any upheavals like general elections. People go up country. That's where home is. That's the familiar place. That's where you feel safe. Or even those who can't go send their kids up there. Right now, with social distancing, for the poorer population of this country, the only place where they can have the luxury of space is up country. Yet now we've locked them up in town in Mathare, Kangemi Pipeline, wherever, whichever crowded place you want to pick. And we've locked them up there. And now they can't send their kids up country or they can't go up country themselves. There they are without the luxury of social distancing. It's really important, I think, as a country that we must delve into our intellectual resources. We must consult experts. We must think about things rather than sort of watching CNN and doing what we see other countries doing on CNN. Yet their resources we have that they don't have, their resources they have that we don't have, their cultural contexts and differences between us that we must acknowledge. And this to me is our biggest failing as a country in the way we have reacted to this crisis.
Coronavirus has, Ogata says, revealed the fallacy of neo-colonial thinking about conservation. He believes that the Kenyan government should pay for it, just as it pays for other matters of state, instead of relying on tourist revenue.
Tourism is a big draw in Kenya, or I should say a big obsession. If you come down to the actual activity, it is pretty exclusive to a small part of our population, but the amount of noise made about it, or the amount of marketing, or the amount of money the government puts into it is huge. It's constantly in our faces. But tourism should always be a byproduct of conservation. It should never be the purpose or reason for conservation. If there's anything like a silver bullet for sorting out the problem we have now, it's understanding of that simple statement. But so far, it's still been very difficult for the policymakers and sector leaders in Kenya to understand that simple statement. This shut down everything. And it has revealed the fallacy of thinking that tourism, safari tourism, can underpin conservation. Our government should take it up as a governmental duty, just the way our government fully funds the Kenya police, the prisons, the military administration, and all these other sectors. Kenya Wildlife Service should not in any way be dependent on tourism earnings in order to perform their constitutional mandate.
Ogata says that the safari tourism model was established by Teddy Roosevelt's trip to Kenya in 1909, during which he and his entourage trekked across the savanna on horseback with black African porters walking alongside and collected animals for the Smithsonian Zoo.
The father of the tourism thinking as it is now, I think, is Teddy Roosevelt with his famous safari to Kenya in 1909. that romanticized it. The long lines of porters trekking across on foot with white people on horses hunting. And that's Roosevelt and his party, the famous photos of it. It's still celebrated in a big way in the U.S. And this is what cemented that power structure.
He said that if he were in power in Kenya, he would create separate ministries of conservation and tourism.
We must divorce conservation from tourism. If I had the power, I'd put them under separate cabinet ministries and separate cabinet ministers so that one takes care of the heritage for our sake. The other now markets what we have taken care of.
Biological diversity, he said, must include human diversity. So tourists who don't want to see Kenyan people shouldn't come to Kenya.
And one of the most fascinating things about Kenya that is not available in any other country in the world is the Kenyan people. Any tourism that's packaged not to include local people is passe. That's completely useless. You often see tourists and tour operators complaining that they went to Samburu or Masai Mara and they saw too many livestock and people around there. If you don't want to see Samburu people, don't come to Kenya. If you don't want to see Maasai people, don't come to Kenya. Nobody ever goes to China and complains that there were too many Chinese people, or Indian complains that there are too many Indian people. So we must include our local people as active intellectual participants in this.
That was Mordecai Ogata, author of The Big Conservation Lie. Audio was borrowed from his interview with Joe Kabuthi on the Elephant podcast on the YouTube. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Are coronavirus vaccines already being tested on human populations? If so, who are the subjects? Lawrence Reyes talks to Professor Deborah Santana in Puerto Rico. They discuss Puerto Rico's colonial status in the context of the 2020 U.S. presidential elections and the long history of medical experimentation on Puerto Ricans and other Black and Brown colonial subjects by U.S. and European powers.
Well, I hear that because it was an election year, and you know all kinds of things happen in election year, the Democrats, of course, are going to try to take advantage of every situation to increase votes for their candidates. And so it, apparently the big thing now is, oh, Puerto Ricans deserve equal rights. And so there are, all of a sudden the new fad is to support Puerto Rican statehood. And it's like, you know, first of all, we know they're doing that because they're assuming, well, if Puerto Rico is a state, you would get all those votes mainly for Democrats. First of all, I wouldn't assume that. And secondly, Puerto Rico, we've never, in any of the referendums, none of which have been binding, statehood's not won, has never won. The majority of people here don't want statehood, and those who do, and I'm not going to minimize them because it's a very large minority who say they're for statehood, they don't say they're for statehood because they feel they identify as North Americans, they identify as Yankees. No, they're Puerto Ricans, they think to get a better economic deal, or they think that, oh, then we can make sure we can see our family. But,
yeah,
but it's
yeah.
not because it's not because of identity. Identity is Puerto Rican, and it's a separate nation. Yeah,
it is. I agree with you. So the last question, and we only have 2 minutes left, is this whole idea of the history that Puerto Ricans have of being experimented on. This whole idea of experimentation without explanation, if you will, like with the birth control pill, like with other experiments that was performed on Puerto Ricans without explanation or without permission. There's something that I read in regards to that they're going to be testing the coronavirus vaccine on the Puerto Rican people. Is that, have you heard anything about that?
Because you know there's a lot of vaccines going, you know, a lot of vaccine trials going all over the place. This particular one I think you're referring to was the from a company called Moderna.
Yes.
Right. And there was an announcement that they were going to do the trials in Puerto Rico, but Moderna has had a problem because they have to do their laboratory trials and their animal trials before they can do human trials. Mm-hmm. And they had some very bad outcomes.
Oh, okay.
So unless somehow, and then all their shares dropped because of the no. Yeah.
Love it.
So unless they can somehow get by that, they're not going to be doing any human trials anytime soon. But yeah, we're on that. We're keeping our mind. The other thing is that this, I just heard that they're releasing millions of genetically modified male mosquitoes in Puerto Rico on the assumption that they will mate with the females, and then they'll all be sterile and we won't have mosquitoes anymore. I mean, but I mean, nobody asked them for this.
It's a pattern. It's always been like that. Yeah.
They've always used us as their
guinea
laboratory
pigs.
Laboratory right. rats, basically.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, it's disgusting and it's tiresome. And I said, you know something? And I just said this because somebody was talking about the UK, England, they're going to do trials in South Africa and Brazil. And I go, you know something? China has several trials going on. They're doing them in China. Russia has a vaccine trial. They're doing it in Russia. Do your own damn vaccine trials in your own country.
That's right. I agree.
You know? Yeah.
Professor Santana, thank you so much for being on the air with us today. Really appreciate your contributions and your knowledge. Do you have anything you want to say going out?
Que viva Puerto Rico libre, and love and solidarity to my friends there. Black lives matter. Black justice matters. You need to get rid of the police. They're nothing more than slave patrols. You need a justice community control way to take care of the safety of our people.
Thanks to Lawrence Reyes for that report.
My hero.
Protests against police violence have coalesced in recent weeks into a movement to defund the New York Police Department to provide more resources for education and other vital services. Pacifica Radio WBAI spoke with Ronnie Almonte, a member of the Movement of Rank and File Educators, a social justice caucus inside the United Federation of Teachers, about the ongoing fight against racism in New York City's public education system.
So I always had a love for science, which is the subject I teach. But since I was in high school, you know, growing up during the Iraq War, growing up in an extremely segregated neighborhood, and growing up in an immigrant family whose members were, you know, domestic workers and restaurant workers, kind of all that made me feel like, you know, I needed to make an impact somehow, and that I could, you know, I could with other people actually kind of make things better, because they're not really that good for working people right now. But when I went into college, you know, I got really hooked onto biology, and I became a researcher, and I went to study in Chicago. And I always had a love for education as well, because I felt like I had a great education and great professors in college, especially. So when I, you know, went to Chicago to actually do research and to study, I was studying to become a biochemist. It so happened that there was a, you know, this union of teachers organized into the Chicago Teachers Union, who were ready to go on strike. Why? Because they were getting paid too little. Okay, that's understandable. But because, you know, the students that they served were being hurt by the policies of the city that prioritized the interests of the rich over the interests of the Black and Brown students in public education. And I saw the Chicago teachers gearing up, getting ready to possibly strike, and then they did. And I saw them strike, and I joined them on the picket lines. And, you know, I felt that, you know, this is something I could do. I had already thought about becoming an educator at some point in my life. But when I saw the Chicago teachers leverage their power, not just for better working conditions, which in itself is important, but by equating their working conditions to their students' learning conditions, that spoke volumes to me. And it showed me that as a teacher, you can actually fight simultaneously for improving your kind of day-to-day livelihood, and for, you know, you can fight for racial justice all at the same time. In fact, you can't really do one well without doing the other in a system as segregated and as racist as the city of Chicago, as the cities of the United States, as the United States itself. So I think for me, that really motivated me to leave my program at the University of Chicago, move back home to New York, and to become a teacher. And not just a teacher who teaches biology, but a teacher who teaches biology in context, because the history of science itself is not immune to moments and instances of racism and of empowerment as well of Black and brown people. And so I kind of wanted to, in the classroom, kind of teach a generation or many generations, hopefully, of young people about kind of that overlapping history of science and of social justice. But I also wanted to kind of use my position as a teacher to also kind of encourage that way of thinking around among my coworkers and my union brothers and sisters. And so that's what we're trying to do today, right? When we're trying to, you know, get the UFT membership to endorse police-free schools and to endorse defunding the NYPD, that's part of that work. And it's hard work, but I'm happy to be doing it. And I think more and more teachers, a wider and wider layer of education workers, are also coming to those conclusions.
That was Ronnie Almonte, member of the Movement of Rank and File Educators, interviewed on Working Class Heroes Radio, which airs on WBAI in New York City. We now go to Steve Zeltzer of the Labor Video Project with an update from the front lines of the fight for fair working conditions.
So this is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica. There is an ongoing struggle in the Bay Area around gentrification, privatization, also attacks on longshore workers and on public schools and the Malcolm X Academy in San Francisco. And journalist Anna Hennessy, who is with us this afternoon, has written about this connection between the billionaires and the community, the Black community and Black workers. Welcome to Pacifica.
Thank you, Steve.
So you recently wrote an article connecting the dots around this issue. Can you talk about what that was about?
Sure. So that was specifically about the Fisher family, Doris Fisher, who is one of the founders of Gap, and her children, Robert, John, and William. The way that they're using their money to dismantle basically the public school system in San Francisco and also to take public land in Oakland.
And how are they doing that?
Well, the Fishers have been supporting the charter movement in California. Doris Fisher is, you know, she's a founder of KIPP Charter School, which is in has a strong presence in San Francisco. And so by bolstering the charter system, they're actually taking money away from public education. This is a broader part and complex part of how the public school system is being defunded over the years and privatized from within by wealthy parents of PTAs, that the money has gone up considerably in the past two decades from PTA money. So we have a segregated school system in San Francisco. This is well known. And we have poorer communities with children of color not receiving the same amount of money in the public school system. And thus, the charters move in and they cherry-pick students, and usually, like in the case of KIPP, these are children who come from low-income families, African-American, Latino, and Pacific Islander, and they go to these charter schools, and then the charter schools continue to take money from SFUSD.
And also there's a connection with the longshoremen, the ILWU, and the threat to their livelihoods by the privatization of the Port of Oakland. What is that connection?
So that connection is John Fisher is, he's the head of a movement to turn the Port of Oakland into thousands of $1 million condos and other private property. That project is known as the Howard Terminal Project. He is also the owner of the A's, the Oakland A's, and he wants to create a new ballpark. And this would all be in a space that is not, has not been privatized in the past.
And the local 10, the Longshore, a large number of them are, the majority are African-American. So it would seem that if the port is threatened, the viability of the port, their jobs would be threatened.
That's correct. So what we, I think, as you know, what we often see with this privatization moves is that they affect communities of color. And in this case, yes, they're taking away the livelihood and the space of African Americans.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much, Anna Hennessy, for joining us on Pacifica. And we've been talking about the privatization both of charter schools and the destruction possibly of the Malcolm X Academy with the KIPP charter, and also the privatization of the Port of Oakland by John Fisher, who's part of the ownership of the Gap, and on both sides of the bay, black workers and poor working class students are being affected, and union families. So thanks for joining us on Pacifica.
That was Steve Zeltzer of the Labor Video Project. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Se perdió el hombre de este siglo allí. Su nombre y su apellido son fusil contra fusil. Se quebró sobre la primera cruz, despierta la verdad, con granizo de plomo acá, su agujero de honor, su canción, dejará
Welcome back to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. We now go to a rarely covered story from the Basque Country from independent journalist, activist, and educator, Inia Martinez.
Things that the coronavirus puts a mask on. Last week, the CIA disclosed a document in which it was revealed that Felipe González was the head of a terrorist paramilitary group called GAL, G-A-L. According to the CIA, Felipe González, the president of Spain from 1982 to 1996, was the head of GAL, this paramilitary terrorist organization dedicated to killing Basque citizens. Now that the CIA has disclosed this piece of information, you would think that Spain would want to do justice. Think again. the only in name socialist party PSOE, the right-wing PP, and the openly fascist Vox, united to vote against the proposal by the Basque Socialist Party Bildu to investigate this accusation of terrorism committed by Felipe González, a head of a state, allegedly also the head of the terrorist organization GAL. Some Spanish ministers were prosecuted and convicted of terrorism in relation to GAL in 1998. José Barrionuevo, Minister of the Interior from 82 to 88, Juan Alberto Belloc, Minister of Interior and Justice from 94 to 96, José Luis Corcuera, Minister of Interior from 88 to 93, and Rafael Vera, Secretary of State Security, among other military men. These Spanish politicians convicted of terrorism in relation to GAL spent less time in prison than the Altsasu 8. And who are the Altsasu 8, you may ask? They are eight young Basques who were accused of terrorism when two Guardia Civils and their girlfriends, all wearing civilian clothes, entered a bar in Altsasu, a Basque village, and started a bar fight in October 2016. Since then, the young Basques have been incarcerated, accused of terrorism. And why would the Spanish occupation forces start a fight in a bar in the Basque country in 2016? The answer is that the Spanish occupation forces working in the Basque country get paid a bonus for as a soft sort of combat pay due to terrorism. ETA, the Basque terrorist group that killed Spanish occupation forces and politicians, had declared the end of ETA in 2011 and never killed again. But the Spanish occupation forces were still getting paid more money. And they had to make up a story to continue getting paid the extra amount they were so used to enjoy. And that's why. Spain, after lengthy fascism from 1939 to 1975, made the appearance of suddenly and magically turning into a democracy, even though the same politicians and the same military police force were in charge. Obviously, it was only pretending. The CIA had been behind all the steps, probably guiding, or who knows, even more, of the so-called Spanish transition from dictatorship to democracy. Another little piece of news that is being conveniently hidden under the mask of coronavirus is the discovery that the former King of Spain, Juan Carlos I, signatory to and collaborator of Franco's fascist dictatorship, had been stealing hundreds of millions of euros and putting them in an offshore account. That's another crime that I'm pretty sure the Spanish government will want to investigate. Just kidding.
That was independent journalist, activist, and educator, Inya Martinez.
Hold on, I'm being told we have breaking news.
Comedian Lee Camp is host of the show Redacted Tonight.
It came out a few days ago, but it's breaking news because it has to do with how our government is breaking. Under the dual-pronged stress of trying to fuse together a patriotic desire to destroy other nations, on one hand, with an equivalent patriotic desire to destroy every American who doesn't have a two-car garage or above. And if you're living in with your extended family inside a two-car garage, that does not count, all right? That does not, if you share your sleeping space with a tricycle, you cannot be accepted into the upper class. Anyway, the breaking news is this. Not long ago, the FBI testified to Congress that they are no longer designating black activists as domestic terrorists or black identity extremists in order to surveil them. You can see how easy that made it for the FBI to violate people's privacy. All they had to do was decide, one, are you black? And two, have you ever mentioned that perhaps maybe things could be a little better for black people in this country? If the answer is yes to both those, then boom, you are a black identity extremist. You have terrorized this country long enough with your stringent militarist signage and your holier-than-thou skin color. We don't know when you might snap, wreaking havoc on your neighborhood Starbucks. And by snap, I mean glaring momentarily at the barista who wrote a racial epithet on the side of your grande almond milk latte. But the FBI testified they are no longer doing that, no longer surveilling people like that. However, Media Justice and the ACLU revealed that the FBI is still surveilling black activists using a dated designation they testified to Congress was no longer in use. Of 1 million pages of documents responsive to a FOIA request, up to one-third of the pages are on open investigations of black people as domestic terrorist threats for potential black identity activities. Yeah, it's true. The FBI has lied to us. I feel betrayed. I feel like I did when I found out Santa Claus was sleeping with my mother. He's old and out of shape. She can do much better. He uses little people slave labor. He's not a good guy, Mom. Point is, the FBI continues to stereotype every black activist as some kind of terror threat, when in fact millions of black people are involved in perfectly peaceful, nonviolent activism. And in fact, black identity terrorism is incredibly rare, if it exists at all, with the exception of Ja Rule. But in the FBI's defense, they stereotype white identity activists too. For example, a few months ago, a group of white armed gunmen walked around Kentucky's Capitol building, and they were stereotyped as not a problem. Furthermore, some white identity police officers terrorize black communities in America, and they are stereotyped as good guys. So, as you can see, white dudes with guns are often judged without even knowing them. My people have been labeled as not a threat for far too long. How dare you, good sir, continue to act as if we are all the same, as if all white folks are not a threat. Who do you think runs PG&E? We can be dangerous. I myself am dangerous. But no, you can't see that, because all you see is my skin color. I'm dangerous. Of course, I could also mention that there's a long history in this country of government agencies working hard to declare black people enemies of the state. And it seems the FBI continues at that task. But, in the FBI's defense, in their double defense, they have always been racist bags. Way to stand by your principles, FBI. You've been racist this long. Why not see it through to the end, huh? What's the end? I don't know, but I can tell it's close. Let's hurry it up, okay? It's called the end of days, not the end of weeks. Let's move it along. I've got things to do. Let's finish her up, FBI.
Today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of our Pacifica sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev. Our national executive producers are Akua Holt, Steve Zeltzer, and Polina Vasiliev. And our executive consultants are Verna Avery Brown at WPFW and Fernando Velasquez at KPFK. I'm Nana Jumpy. Thanks for listening, and make sure to tune in tomorrow.
If you tuned in late, you can listen and download the show from the website covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.